A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about the Nordic countries and how they keep showing up as the gold standard whenever people talk about smart social policy. He's asking two things, really. First, do people actually living in Sweden or Denmark or Finland realize how forward-thinking some of their policies are, or is it just normal to them? And second, the more interesting question, what have the Nordics actually struggled with? Where does the model break down when you look past the glossy brochure version? Because it's probably unfair to treat the place like some frozen utopia where nothing ever goes wrong.
This is my kind of question, and I should say up front, I've read a lot on this, but I've never lived there, so I'm going to be careful about making claims about what it feels like from the inside. But the data is fascinating, and some of it really does complicate the story. And I think the way Daniel framed it, the glossy brochure version, is exactly right. There's a whole genre of journalism and policy writing that treats the Nordics like a political science petting zoo. You fly in, you spend 4 days in Copenhagen, you marvel at the bike lanes and the pastries, and you fly home and write 3,000 words about how Denmark solved capitalism. Nobody ever writes about the guy who's been on a waiting list for a hip replacement since the Obama administration.
The policy tourism circuit. It's like when urban planners visit Barcelona and come back insisting every city needs superblocks, without asking what Barcelona residents actually think about them.
And the locals are often the first to tell you what's broken, if you bother to ask. So let's do that. Start with the part where the brochure is actually right. What have they genuinely figured out that the rest of us should be stealing shamelessly? Universal childcare is the one I'd put at the top of the list. In Sweden, municipalities are legally required to provide a preschool place within 3 to 4 months of a parent requesting it. The cost is capped, there's a maximum fee, what they call max taxa, and for a second child you pay less, for a third child even less. It's designed so that having multiple kids doesn't bankrupt you on childcare. And the result is that Sweden has one of the highest female labor force participation rates in the world. In Denmark, it's similar. They spend roughly 1.3% of GDP on early childhood education and care, which is among the highest in the OECD.
The childcare system basically functions as an engine for getting women into the workforce, not a side perk.
And the evidence on long-term outcomes is strong. There's a well-known study from Norway that looked at the phased rollout of subsidized childcare in the 1970s and found that children who attended had higher educational attainment and higher earnings as adults. The effects were largest for children from low-income families. This wasn't just babysitting, it was an investment that paid off decades later.
Which is the kind of sentence that would make a certain type of American policymaker break out in hives. Any social spending that takes 30 years to show a return.
That's the core difference in the political economy, right? The Nordic model accepts a longer time horizon for returns. You see this in infrastructure planning, too. When Copenhagen decided to build its metro expansion, they planned it on a 50-year horizon. In the US, we debate whether a bridge can survive the next election cycle. Parental leave is another one. Sweden offers 480 days of paid parental leave, with 90 of those days reserved specifically for each parent, the so-called daddy quota or use, it or lose it months. The replacement rate is about 80% of income up to a cap. Norway has a similar setup, and you can use those days until the child is 12.
That's not parental leave. That's a long-term strategic reserve of days off.
And the interesting design feature is those non-transferable months. When Sweden introduced the first daddy month in 1995, it changed behavior. Before the reform, fathers took about 6% of all parental leave days. After the reform, it rose sharply. It normalized the idea that fathers take leave. That's what good policy design looks like. It doesn't just incentivize, it shifts norms.
The state engineered a cultural shift through benefit design, which is either brilliant social engineering or deeply intrusive, depending on your priors.
That tension is real. But I'd note that the policy was responding to a stated goal, gender equality, and it worked. It wasn't some hidden agenda. It was debated openly and implemented transparently. And there's a practical detail here that I think gets overlooked. The daddy months aren't just about gender equality in some abstract sense. They change the relationship between fathers and their children at a formative moment. There's research showing that fathers who take extended leave early on are more involved in childcare years later. The policy doesn't just redistribute labor in the present, it rewires family dynamics for the long term.
The policy creates a habit, and the habit becomes the new normal. The state isn't just handing out days off. It's shaping the default template for what a father does.
And that's a much deeper intervention than simply writing a check. It's using policy to say, we, as a society, think fathers should be present. And then making it financially feasible for them to be present. That's the difference between a value stated in a speech and a value embedded in the machinery of government.
What else goes in the brochure?
The flexicurity model in Denmark is innovative. It combines flexible hiring and firing rules. Employers can dismiss workers relatively easily, with generous unemployment benefits and active labor market policies that retrain people. The state spends heavily on helping displaced workers find new jobs. The result is high job mobility without the kind of precarity you'd expect. Danish workers change jobs frequently but don't fall through the cracks.
It's like a trampoline instead of a safety net. You bounce back up rather than just not hitting the ground.
That's exactly the metaphor the Danish Labor Ministry uses, and the data bears it out. Denmark has one of the highest job turnover rates in the OECD, but also one of the lowest rates of long-term unemployment. Workers aren't scared of losing their jobs because the system is designed to catch them and redirect them.
How does the retraining part actually work in practice? Because I feel like active labor market policies is one of those phrases that sounds great in a policy paper and could mean anything from useful skills training to mandatory resume, writing workshops that accomplish nothing.
The Danish system is more toward the useful end of the spectrum, though it's not perfect. Unemployed workers are assigned a caseworker relatively quickly, and there's an individualized action plan. The state subsidizes vocational training programs that are designed in collaboration with industry, so you're not learning abstract skills, you're learning what local employers actually need. There's also a system of wage subsidies, where the state covers part of a worker's salary for a trial period with a new employer. The idea is to reduce the risk for the employer to take a chance on someone who's been displaced. And there are strict participation requirements. You have to engage with the system to keep receiving benefits.
It's not unconditional. There's a quid pro quo. The state will catch you, but you have to swim toward the shore.
And that's an important part of the political sustainability. The Danish population is willing to fund generous benefits because there's a strong norm of reciprocity. You don't just get to sit at home indefinitely. The system is designed to push people back into the labor market, and the public supports that conditionality.
Does all of this require a level of trust in government that most countries simply don't have?
Yes, and that brings us to the cracks. Because that trust is not a given, and it's been eroding.
Let's go there. The prompt specifically asked about what they've struggled with. Start with the thing that surprised you most.
Integration of immigrants. This is the one where the Nordic model has been tested most severely, and the results have been sobering. Sweden took in more asylum seekers per capita than any other European country during the 2015 migration wave. At its peak, Sweden received about 163,000 asylum applications in a single year in a country of 10 million people. That would be proportionally like the United States taking in over 5 million asylum seekers in one year.
That's staggering. And the aftermath?
Employment gaps are persistent. According to OECD data, the employment rate for foreign-born residents in Sweden lags about 15 to 20 percentage points behind the native-born rate. The gap is even wider for women from certain regions. Housing segregation has intensified. There are now areas the Swedish police classify as särskilt utsatta områden, particularly vulnerable areas where the state has effectively lost control of parts of the neighborhood. Gang violence has risen sharply. Sweden went from having one of the lowest rates of gun homicide in Europe to one of the highest in just over a decade.
That's a stunning reversal. And it's not just Sweden, right?
Denmark has taken a much more restrictive approach to immigration for years, partly in response to similar concerns. They've passed something like 120 immigration restrictions since 2001, including a controversial law that allows the state to seize valuables from asylum seekers above a certain threshold, the so-called jewelry law, which generated a lot of international criticism. Finland and Norway have their own versions of these tensions. In Norway, children of immigrants are substantially overrepresented in child welfare interventions, which has led to diplomatic disputes, including with Poland and the Czech Republic.
You've got this paradox. These are societies built on high trust and strong social cohesion, and they're struggling to extend that model to newcomers. The machinery works for people who are already inside the circle.
Some would argue the machinery only works because the circle was small and homogeneous to begin with. That's the uncomfortable argument. The Nordic model emerged in countries that were ethnically and culturally homogeneous for most of their history, with strong Lutheran traditions and high baseline trust. When you introduce diversity at scale and at speed, you stress test the model in ways it wasn't designed for.
It's the kind of observation that gets you called unpleasant names in certain circles, but the data is the data. What else is cracking?
Healthcare waiting times are a persistent and deeply unpopular problem. In Sweden, the guaranteed maximum wait for specialist care is 90 days, but a significant share of patients wait longer. In Norway, waiting times for elective surgery have been a political football for decades. The Danish healthcare system has similar bottlenecks. A 2023 report from the Swedish National Audit Office found that roughly 1 in 4 patients waited longer than the legal maximum for their first specialist visit.
Universal access doesn't guarantee timely access. You get the appointment, eventually, after your condition has either resolved itself or gotten much worse.
That's the trade-off these systems make. They prioritize equity of access over speed, and they contain costs by constraining supply. But for a lot of people, that trade-off feels less like a feature and more like a bug. There's a growing private healthcare sector in all of these countries, which creates its own equity problems. People who can pay jump the queue.
The two-tier system sneaking in through the back door. And this is where I wonder about the political psychology. Because if you're a Swede who's paid 40-something percent of your income in taxes your whole life, and then you need a knee surgery, and you're told it'll be 14 months, and your neighbor just pays out of pocket and gets it done next week, that feels like a betrayal of the social contract.
It absolutely does. And it's one of the most politically volatile issues in the region. There's a constant tension between the egalitarian principles the system was built on and the reality that people with means are increasingly opting out. Once the wealthy start using private healthcare and private schools, their willingness to pay high taxes for public services they're not using starts to erode. It's a slow-motion unraveling of the solidarity that funds the whole thing. What about education? PISA scores, that's the OECD's program for international student assessment, have been declining in all the Nordic countries for years. Finland was the poster child for educational excellence in the early 2000s. Everyone made pilgrimages to Helsinki to study the miracle, but Finland's scores have dropped significantly since then. Sweden had its own crisis earlier and implemented reforms. Norway and Denmark have seen similar trends, though less dramatic.
What's driving the decline?
Multiple factors, and nobody agrees on the main cause. Some point to increased immigration and the challenges of educating children who arrive without the local language. Others point to the rise of smartphones and screen time. There's evidence that reading habits have declined. Nordic kids read fewer books than they used to. Others argue that the pedagogical model shifted too far towards student-directed learning and away from direct instruction. And there's been a broader decline in teacher status and pay relative to other professions.
It's a stew of demographic change, technology, pedagogy, and labor market incentives. Nobody gets to claim a single cause explanation.
And that's what makes it a hard policy problem. If it were just one thing, you'd fix it. When it's six things interacting, the fixes get complicated. I'll add one more layer. There's a fascinating debate in Sweden about whether the school choice reforms of the 1990s contributed to the decline. Sweden introduced a universal voucher system that allowed private, for-profit schools to compete with public schools. Proponents said it would drive innovation and quality. Critics say it increased segregation and grade inflation without improving actual learning outcomes.
Wait, Sweden has for-profit schools. That seems wildly off-brand.
It surprises a lot of people. But yes, since the early 90s, Sweden has had one of the most market-oriented school systems in the world. Any qualified provider can open a school, receive public funding per student, and keep any profits. Some of the largest school chains are owned by private equity firms. It's a policy experiment that's been watched closely around the world, and the results are, to put it mildly, contested.
The country that's the global symbol of social democracy also pioneered for profit education. That's a plot twist I did not see coming.
The Nordics are full of these contradictions. They're not ideologically pure in the way outsiders often assume. They're pragmatic, they experiment, and sometimes the experiments don't work out.
Let's go back to the first part of the prompt, the self-awareness question. Do people living in these countries actually know how unusual their policies are?
From what I've gathered reading surveys and qualitative research, the answer is mixed. There's definitely a baseline awareness. Most Swedes know their parental leave is generous by international standards. Most Danes know their unemployment system is unusual. But I think there's also a kind of normalization that sets in. When you've never known anything else, it's hard to appreciate how exceptional it is.
Like a fish not knowing it's wet.
And there's a related phenomenon where the Nordic countries are actually quite self-critical internally. The public debate in Sweden or Denmark is as fierce as anywhere else. They're not sitting around congratulating themselves. They're arguing about waiting times and gang violence and school quality. The utopian image is largely an external projection.
Which creates this weird dynamic where outsiders think the place is paradise, and insiders think everything is falling apart. And the truth is somewhere in the middle, probably closer to the insider view.
There's a Danish sociologist, I can't recall the name, who described it as the Nordic paradox. These are the countries that score highest on happiness surveys, but also have high rates of antidepressant use and loneliness, particularly among young people. The World Happiness Report consistently ranks Finland, Denmark, and Sweden in the top 10, but Finland also has one of the highest youth suicide rates in Western Europe.
Wait, that's a striking contrast. High happiness, high antidepressant use, high youth suicide. What's the explanation?
One hypothesis is that the happiness surveys capture life satisfaction, a cognitive evaluation of how your life is going, rather than moment-to-moment emotional experience. You can judge your life as going well while still feeling depressed. Another hypothesis is that the social safety net reduces certain kinds of misery but doesn't address existential or psychological distress. And some researchers argue that the high expectations created by living in a well-functioning society make disappointment sharper when things go wrong.
The safety net catches you if you lose your job, but it doesn't catch you if you lose your sense of meaning.
This connects to a broader critique of the Nordic model that it's very good at material security, but less effective at addressing what you might call spiritual or communal needs. The welfare state can crowd out civil society. If the state does everything, what's left for families and communities and churches to do?
There's a conservative critique buried in there. The state is an overbearing parent that atrophies the muscles of community self-reliance.
It's not just conservatives making that argument. There's a tradition on the left, too, of worrying about the state displacing organic solidarity. But the Nordic countries do have strong civil society traditions. Unions, adult education associations, sports clubs, volunteer organizations. It's not like community has vanished. It's more that certain kinds of intimate care have been professionalized and institutionalized.
Like elder care?
In the Nordic model, the state takes primary responsibility for elder care rather than expecting families to do it. That frees up women in particular from unpaid care work, which is the upside. The downside is that it can weaken intergenerational bonds. There's evidence that loneliness among the elderly is a serious problem in Sweden, and it's partly because the expectation that families will care for aging parents has been replaced by the expectation that the state will handle it.
You trade family obligation for individual freedom, and you get some loneliness as a byproduct. That's almost a microcosm of the entire modern condition.
That's the trade-off in a nutshell, and whether it's worth it depends on your values. But you can't pretend the trade-off doesn't exist. And I think this is where the Nordic model forces a deeper philosophical question. What is the good life? Is it maximum autonomy, where no one depends on you, and you don't depend on anyone except the state? Or is there something lost when the bonds of obligation between generations are replaced by a tax-funded care worker who clocks in and clocks out?
That's a hard question, and I don't think there's a clean answer. But I suspect most people would say they want some mix. The freedom to not be crushed by caregiving obligations, but also the warmth of family connections that aren't fully mediated by a government agency. The trick is getting the balance right.
The Nordics may have overcorrected in one direction. That's the argument anyway.
What about the economic sustainability question? The Nordic model is expensive. Does the math work long term?
That's the trillion kroner question. The Nordic countries fund their welfare states through high tax to GDP ratios. Denmark's tax to GDP ratio is around 47%. Sweden and Finland are in the mid-40s. That's sustainable as long as the economy grows and the dependency ratio, workers to non-workers, stays healthy.
The dependency ratio is not staying healthy.
It's not. Like most developed countries, the Nordics are aging. By 2030, more than 1 in 5 Swedes will be over 65. That means fewer workers supporting more retirees. Immigration was supposed to help with this. Bring in younger workers to expand the tax base. But the integration failures we talked about mean that hasn't worked as planned. If immigrants have lower employment rates, they don't generate the tax revenue that the model requires.
The immigration policy that was meant to shore up the welfare state is instead straining it.
In the short to medium term, yes. In the long term, it depends on whether the children of immigrants integrate into the labor market more successfully than their parents. There's some evidence that second-generation outcomes are better, but the data is mixed and country-specific. And there's a timing problem. The demographic pressure is now, but the payoff from second-generation integration is 20 years away. The fiscal math doesn't wait.
Let's talk about housing. I've heard that Sweden in particular has a bizarre rental system.
Oh, this is a fascinating case study in good intentions gone wrong. Sweden has rent controls that keep prices below market rates in many areas. That sounds great in theory, affordable housing for everyone. In practice, it's created a system where you need to be on a waiting list for years, sometimes decades, to get a rental apartment in Stockholm. The average wait time for a rent-controlled apartment in central Stockholm is something like 15 to 20 years.
15 to 20 years? That's not a housing policy. That's a patience-based lottery.
It creates all kinds of distortions. People hold on to apartments they don't need because they're so valuable. A black market for rental contracts has emerged. Young people can't move to the city for jobs because there's nowhere to live. The system is supposed to protect tenants, and it does protect the ones who are already in, but it locks everyone else out.
The insider-outsider problem again.
It keeps recurring. And this is where I think the Nordic model has a genuine blind spot. The model works brilliantly for people who are inside the system, citizens, long-term residents, people with stable jobs and family connections. It's much harder to access if you're young, newly arrived, or otherwise outside the established networks. The housing queues are a perfect illustration. If your parents put you on the Stockholm housing list when you were born, which some families literally do, you might have an apartment by the time you're an adult. If you move to Sweden at age 30, forget it. You're competing in the unregulated sublet market, paying whatever someone demands with no security of tenure.
The system effectively transfers wealth and security from newcomers to incumbents, all while using the language of universalism and solidarity.
And that's the uncomfortable reality. The universalism is real, but it's universalism for the patient, the connected, and the long established. It's not universalism for the person who just arrived with a job offer and needs somewhere to live next month.
The model's strength, deep social solidarity, is also its weakness. The solidarity extends only to people you recognize as part of the community.
That recognition is not automatic. It's built over time through shared institutions and shared identity. When the pace of change is slow, the circle can expand gradually. When it's fast, the circle contracts defensively.
Which is basically the story of the Sweden Democrats and the Danish People's Party and all the other right-wing populist movements that have risen in the Nordics over the last decade or two.
The Sweden Democrats went from being a fringe neo-Nazi adjacent party in the 1990s to winning over 20% of the vote and becoming the second largest party in parliament. They're now a support party for the current center-right government. In Denmark, the Danish People's Party had a similar trajectory, though they've declined more recently. In Finland, the Finns Party has been in government. This isn't a marginal phenomenon. It's the central political story of the region over the last 20 years.
These parties are running explicitly on the idea that the welfare state needs to be protected from outsiders, not extended to them.
That's the welfare chauvinism argument. Generous benefits for us, not for them. It's a direct challenge to the universalist logic that the Nordic model was built on, and it's been electorally successful. What's fascinating is how the mainstream parties have responded. In Denmark, the Social Democrats essentially adopted much of the Danish People's Party's immigration platform and won back power. In Sweden, the traditional center-right parties eventually decided to work with the Sweden Democrats rather than maintain the old cordon sanitaire. The political landscape has fundamentally shifted.
The populist right didn't just win votes. They reshaped the entire political conversation. Even the parties that oppose them now operate on terrain they defined.
That's exactly what happened. And it's a pattern you see across Europe, but it's particularly striking in the Nordics precisely because these were supposed to be the societies most immune to this kind of politics. The places with the strongest social safety nets, the highest trust, the most equality, and they still produced powerful nativist movements. That should tell us something about the limits of economic policy to address questions of identity and belonging.
I want to push on something. We've been cataloging problems. Integration, healthcare queues, educational decline, housing distortions, political fragmentation. But these are still among the richest, most equal, most stable societies on Earth. Is the criticism fair? Or are we grading on an impossibly steep curve?
That's a fair pushback. If you look at the Gini coefficient, the standard measure of income inequality, all five Nordic countries are in the bottom 20 globally, meaning they're among the most equal societies in the world. Their poverty rates, especially child poverty, are low by international standards. Life expectancy is high. Corruption is low. Social mobility is relatively high. On almost any composite measure of human development, they're at or near the top.
The criticism is basically that the valedictorian got a B+ in one class, and we're treating it like a crisis.
But I think the reason these critiques matter is precisely because the Nordic model is held up as the gold standard. If even the best performing systems have serious problems, that tells us something important about the limits of social engineering. It's not that the model is bad, it's that no model solves everything. Every system has trade-offs. The Nordics have made different trade-offs than the United States or the UK, and on balance they've made better ones. But they haven't escaped the fundamental dilemma of how to balance freedom and security, diversity and solidarity, present consumption and future investment.
The problems they're facing, aging populations, integration of immigrants, housing affordability, healthcare costs, those are the exact same problems every developed country is facing. The Nordics are just dealing with them from a stronger starting position.
That's the glass half full framing. The glass half-empty framing is that they've built a system that requires high growth, high trust, and high homogeneity to function, and all three are under pressure simultaneously.
Let's talk about one more thing before we wrap. The innovation paradox. These high-tax, high-regulation economies are also, somehow, hotbeds of entrepreneurship and technological innovation. Spotify is Swedish. Lego and Novo Nordisk are Danish. Nokia was Finnish, and even after the phone business collapsed, Finland has a thriving startup scene. Norway's sovereign wealth fund is the largest in the world, built on oil revenue that they had the foresight to save rather than spend.
This is one of my favorite aspects of the Nordic model. It contradicts the simplistic narrative that high taxes and strong social safety nets kill innovation. The argument goes that if the state cushions failure, people are more willing to take risks. Starting a company in Sweden or Denmark is less terrifying than in the United States because if it fails, you still have healthcare and a basic income floor.
Socialize risk. Privatize reward. That's a neat trick if you can pull it off.
The evidence suggests they do pull it off. The Nordic countries consistently rank high in innovation indices. Sweden has among the highest rates of patent applications per capita in the world. Denmark has a thriving biotech sector. The startup ecosystem in Helsinki is disproportionately large for a country of 5.5 million people, and it's not just the big names. Sweden has produced a steady stream of tech companies, Klarna, King, Mojang, iZettle. Per capita, Stockholm produces more unicorns than any city outside Silicon Valley.
Though I'd note that many of these success stories, Spotify, for instance, went public and scaled globally in ways that don't necessarily feed back into the domestic tax base in the same way. The founders get rich, the company is listed in New York, and the Swedish state doesn't capture as much of the upside as you might expect.
That's true, and it's a live policy debate in the region. But the counterpoint is that the ecosystem itself creates jobs and spillover effects domestically. The talent pool deepens, the venture capital market matures, and the next generation of founders learns from the previous one. It's not just about tax revenue from the unicorn itself. The early Spotify employees who got equity and then left to start their own companies, those knock-on effects are substantial and they stay in the ecosystem.
It's less about capturing the unicorn and more about fertilizing the soil that grows the next 10.
That's the argument. And there's a cultural dimension too. The Nordic countries have a particular attitude toward work and creativity that might be conducive to certain kinds of innovation. Flat hierarchies, high levels of trust within organizations, a willingness to collaborate across sectors. These are soft factors, but they matter.
What's the takeaway here? If I'm a policymaker in a country that's not in the Nordic Club, what do I actually steal from this model? And what do I leave on the shelf?
I'd say steal the universal childcare, steal the active labor market policies, steal the use it or lose it parental leave. Those are concrete, evidence-backed interventions that pay for themselves over the long run. Be more cautious about the high-tax funding model. The Nordics can sustain it because of high baseline trust and specific historical conditions that don't necessarily travel well.
What do you leave on the shelf?
The rent control system. The assumption that homogeneity will persist. The idea that a generous welfare state can be extended to everyone immediately without building the institutional and cultural foundations first. The Nordics built their systems over decades, starting from societies that were already relatively equal and cohesive. Trying to copy the end result without the historical foundation is likely to disappoint.
The real lesson isn't the policies themselves, it's the patience. These systems were built incrementally, with broad political consensus, over a long period.
That's the part that's hardest to replicate. You can't fast-forward trust building. You can't legislate social cohesion into existence. The Nordic model is as much a cultural achievement as a policy one. It emerged from a particular set of historical circumstances. Small, homogeneous populations, a strong labor movement, a Protestant work ethic, a tradition of pragmatic compromise. Those aren't things you can import in a shipping container.
Which brings us back to the prompt's original question. Do the Nordics know what they've built? I suspect the answer is yes, but they also know what it cost and what it's costing. They're not naive about the trade-offs, even if the rest of us sometimes are.
I think that's right. The self-image is more complicated than the external image, and that's probably healthy. The moment a society starts believing its own press releases is the moment it stops noticing the problems accumulating under the surface.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late 1600s, Vanuatuan cooks on the island of Malekula prepared lap-lap, a baked pudding of grated yam and coconut cream, in the hollowed-out trunks of felled cycad trees. The cycad trunk's inner surface, when repeatedly heated, developed a natural glassy sheen from the caramelized plant resins, creating a cooking vessel that was simultaneously nonstick, heat-resistant, and faintly translucent when held up to strong sunlight.
Translucent cookware from tree innards.
I don't know what to do with that.
That's the point. Though I will say, there's something almost Nordic about it. Making ingenious use of limited local materials, patiently developing a technique over generations, ending up with something that sounds too elegant to be true.
I was not expecting you to tie the Vanuatuan cycad trunk back to the Nordic model, but I have to admit, it kind of works.
Everything connects if you squint hard enough.
One forward-looking thought. The real test of the Nordic model isn't the next 5 years, it's the next 20. Can these societies maintain the trust and solidarity that makes their policies work while becoming more diverse, more digital, and more globally integrated? I don't think anyone knows the answer.
That's the question worth watching. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com and on Spotify. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to us. show my weird prompts where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.